introduce us. Okay, it's Richard Mackey with the UBC Law History Project. It's the 24th of April, 2013. Graham Zilm is here, and we're talking today to Sven Robinson, who's flown in from Switzerland, especially for Hi, Sven.
And be with you.
We don't have a lot of time, so I thought maybe we could start with, we could go right to UBC, to the law school, to your, and possibly to the connections between law and politics, or between law school politics. And, was law school a very conservative discipline or place at that time?
It was a conservative place, but I mean, it's funny when you ask about law and politics, and for me, I went into law basically because I knew that I had the political bug, and I was originally going to go into medicine. I did pre-med at UBC. I was in the Faculty of Sciences, and in fact, I was on the AMS, the Alma Mater Society, the Students Council, and then I was on the Senate of the university, representing medical and science students. But I was also very active politically, both in student politics, and at that time it was the NDP in government in British Columbia, mm-hmm. Dave Barrett, Premier Dave Barrett, from 72 to 75, and I went into law school in 74. But prior to that, I was president of the Younger Democrats, very active politically, and on the Senate, I knew Bertie McLean, mm-hmm. who was the dean of the law school. And at the last minute, I'd been accepted into UBC Medical School, and I was all set to go to medical school. I thought, no, that's crazy. I should be going to law. And I was very fortunate because I'd just been awarded something called the Sherwood Lett Memorial Scholarship, mm-hmm. which was one of the sort of most prestigious mm-hmm. scholarships at the university. And McLean knew me, and I had good marks and so on. So I groveled and appealed, and I was... I was accepted into law school. But I, from the time I went in, from before I went in fact, there's some old interviews in the UBC newspaper, I saw that basically as a, sort of a vehicle to get involved in politics. So that's what law was about for me. It wasn't about going out and practicing particularly. It was about learning the law, and then hopefully those skills that I learned, not just the substance of the law, but how to think like a lawyer, would make me an effective representative of other people.
Was there one episode or influence that shaped you before you in your politics before you came to law school?
Before I got to law school, well, I started out early. I mean, I was knocking on doors when I was 14 years old for Eileen Daly in North Burnaby. Just after my family moved into Burnaby, we moved up from the United States. My parents, along with a lot of other folks, didn't want to support an immoral war in Vietnam. And so my dad was offered a position at Simon Fraser University. And we moved north and lived on Capitol Hill in North Burnaby, which I can see from here. Then known affectionately as Red Hill, very left-wing area. And I canvassed for Eileen Daly. My first federal campaign was in 68. I campaigned for Tommy Douglas, who lost in that election. He was representing Burnaby. And just got more and more involved in
politics.
So
it was a family...
I mean, my
family tradition.
Politics as such wasn't. I mean, my dad had sort of contempt for social democrats. He was, you know, very radical, and sort of, you know, organized politics. But
what was his field? What did he teach?
He taught English and English literature at SFU. But I thought, you know, law would be a interesting and challenging route to politics, basically. And it was. I mean, I had three great years, although I was known affectionately by some of my professors as the Phantom of UBC Law School during that time, because I didn't spend a lot of time in classes. And, I mean, Eric Todd used to be quite vicious. Is he still alive, or, you know? Todd, yeah. He was my property law professor and a very crusty conservative professor. And I would show up at the last minute late, and he would kick me out of the class, very in front of everybody, you know, because I was late. Until finally I just refused to leave, and that was the end of that. But I didn't spend a lot of time in classes, because I was so active, both on campus and off campus. In 76, for example, I was elected as one of the first two students to be elected to the Board of Governors of UBC, which was quite satisfying, because I had actually been a member of a commission appointed by Eileen Daly, who was then the Minister of Education, to look at changes to post-secondary education in BC. It was presided by a guy named John Bremer, who ended up being fired by Dave Barrett. I was the student representative on that commission, and I recommended, and the commission accepted the recommendation that students should be involved in governance of universities, and that non-academic staff should be involved as well. That was a revolutionary thing. The people that worked in support, the janitors, the secretaries, and so on. So the Universities Act was changed, and then there were elections for the first two students to serve on the UBC board, and I ran together with a woman I remember named Jeanette Auger, who was the chair of the women's caucus on campus, the women's center on campus. And funnily enough, I was elected, but this extremely conservative engineer was also elected. So the two of us were the first two students and duked it out during most of the year. Until I ended up actually very publicly resigning from the board just before my term ended. It was in December, in solidarity with the support staff. There was a union there called AUSI, and they were the union representing the support staff. And they got quite a raw deal. And I was on the finance committee of the board, and it was pretty clear to me that the university administration was basically trying to smash this union. And I had some documents that made that pretty clear. They hired a guy named Chuck Conahan to do what they could to weaken the union. And so I spoke at a big rally off campus of about over 1,000 of these support staff. It was in November of 76. Oh, no, sorry. Was it 76? November of... Yeah, it would have been November of... November 75, yeah. And I resigned from the board in protest over what was going on. And these support staff went out on strike. First in the history of UBC. First strike by support staff at UBC. And I supported them and joined them on the picket line. But what I remember, and this is quite sad, was that many, many law students were quite contemptuous of these workers and didn't support the strike and crossed the picket line and were rude and insulting to some of the workers themselves. And I still remember that, and I remember being sort of shocked and disappointed that the response of my fellow law students to that strike, it was incredibly conservative and not respectful of the rights of these workers that were struggling for better conditions of employment. And so to come back to your original question, Richard, when you asked us, was it conservative? I mean, that was really conservative.
So they were vocal in their entitlement.
In opposition to the what these workers were seeking to achieve. And, you know, I got some flack from some of my fellow students for supporting them. Not that that worried me particularly. And not that there weren't other students that supported them. Of course there were. But overall, the law faculty was by far the most conservative, that in engineering, in their response to this strike of support staff, which was very disappointing.
And of the colleagues and of your contemporaries and professors, who would you remember as being influential?
Stands out.
Well,
Tony Hickling was one of my favorites. He was a labor law professor, and I really enjoyed his classes and was really stimulated by his teaching and what he shared with us. And it stimulated me to actually go into labor law and sort of specialize in labor law. Although, and there's another funny story. So Tony was great. Peter Burns, another professor named Peter Burns.
We've talked to him.
Did you talk to Peter? Yeah.
Yeah.
Peter was terrific. I mean, just a great professor. I did criminal justice with Peter. Yeah. Is he still teaching as well, or is he retired?
He teaches, but he's at the
there's an international center.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. He was a great professor. I really enjoyed his courses. I mean, Todd, in his crusty way, was a good professor. I learned a lot from him about property law. It was dreadfully boring, but I mean, it was a good course. And there was a guy named McDougall who taught family law that I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
And Barry Slutsky, is he still around?
Yes.
Is he still around?
He is.
Oh, okay.
Well, one or two people have suggested we talk to him. I think he's still.
Yeah, you might want to talk to Barry. Yeah, yeah. I mean, those are some of the names that I remember particularly. But Hickling really stood out. And you know, I was thinking back, I didn't have any women professors. You know, it was a bunch of guys, white guys, mostly conservative white guys. I'm sure, I know that's changed significantly. I mean, just look at the dean, right? You know, out lesbian woman, right? I mean, that would have been unthinkable back then. So that's, I mean, and the face of the law faculty has really changed quite profoundly. But back then it was pretty white and pretty male.
And the students, the other...
And the students, too.
Did you have friends who shared your political
philosophy?
And
No, there was a good group of progressive students there. A couple of my closest friends, we thought at one point of forming a law firm. And our pictures, you know, they had these pictures with your little, I don't know if they still do it, with the little tabs.
They still do that? My graduation class.
Yeah, exactly, that's right. Well, you know, I had I had this curly hair. You've seen that, I don't know if you've seen the pictures, right? But, you know, this curly hair. And, you know, like, I looked about 12 years old. And then my friends, we joked that our based on the pictures, our law school pictures, that we were going to open a firm called Fang, Horse, and Angel. I was Angel. I looked quite angelic. My friend Sandy Smale, she was Fang. She had her picture like that. You can't see that on the mics, but, you know, baring her teeth. And then Wayne Moore was Horse. You know, he was long, serious. And we were going to open up Fang, Horse, and Angel. And we've remained friends over the years, and Sandy practices law still in Kimberley, in British Columbia. And Wayne is one of the most senior labor law arbitrators. And he actually joined the firm that I joined. And therein lies another story, actually. Mm-hmm. That strike that I told you about, and resigning from the board, I also made public the these negotiating documents of the board that showed that they were trying to smash the union. That didn't go over too well with some of my colleagues on the board. The chair of the board was a guy named Tom Dome, former BC Supreme Court judge, and I had been offered a position articling with his firm, Dome Russell Kaworski, I think it was called, very prestigious firm, and I decided to take that, you know, to article with them. After I quit the board, Tom was still very supportive of me, but his partner said, "We don't know about this guy. He's probably too radical for our firm." Mm-hmm. And so they summoned me to a meeting at the Vancouver Club to talk about whether or not they were going to withdraw the offer of articles. And I refused to meet them at the Vancouver Club because I said it was a sexist club. They didn't take women. Mm-hmm. So that also endeared me to some of them. Mm-hmm. So we met at the law firm offices, and this would be probably January of 76. And, you know, they tried to get me to sort of apologize for what I'd done and everything else. And we had a knockdown, drag-out battle, and at the end of the day, by one vote majority, they voted to withdraw my articles. Dome did not support that decision and ended up leaving the firm. And he was the head of the firm, former Supreme Court judge.
How did you spell his name?
D-O-H-M.
Right.
Tom Dome. His son, actually, I think, is still a judge, but he was a Supreme Court judge. Great guy. Very fine guy. And so my articles were gone in January, right? So what do I do then? That was not easy. But I had some other offers, but I decided to go with Fang, my friend Sandy Smale. Yeah. She had already decided to go to LSE, London School of Economics, to do an LLM. And so I decided I was going to do that too. And so I had some other offers, but I went to LSE for a year and had a wonderful experience at LSE, some amazing professors at LSE.
Who were some of them?
Oh, I mean, one that really stands out is a guy named Bill Wedderburn. Wedderburn. He was I did labor law with him, and he was legendary. He basically wrote the leading labor law text in the UK, and was on a royal commission looking at industrial law in the UK. And I just had a wonderful year, and I stayed in touch with him until he died last year, actually. The year I was there, he was appointed to the House of Lords. Lord Wedderburn, he was a Marxist, and I took great pleasure in needling him about joining this bastion of elitism in the House of Lords. But he said he was joining because he got free newspaper and magazine subscriptions, and it gave him a platform to spread his Marxist propaganda. So, and he did for some 30 years afterwards, very effectively and very eloquently. But before I left, I met a guy named Bob Gardner, heard about what had happened to me, sort of it spread among the legal circles, about my article being withdrawn. He was with a company called Ferris & Company, very respected company, and he decided to leave Ferris and form his own firm. And he asked me if I would join him, an article with him. And so I said, sure, but I can't do that for a year because I'm going to LSE. But I did. When I got back, I articled with him. Was called to the bar in September of 78, and in May of 79 was elected to the House of Commons. At the tender age of 27. and stayed there for 25 years.
Always on the federal level?
Yeah, I was. I represented Burnaby in various configurations. My riding boundaries changed. And for a while I represented the east end of Vancouver as well. That was part of my riding. A riding called Burnaby Kingsway for about 10 years. Shared it with Glenn Clark and a young guy named Adrian Dix, who was working for him. I went through seven elections until my crash and burn in April of 2004, when I didn't run again.
And did you ever have ambitions to get involved with the NDP provincially?
Never. No. No, I was always, I mean, the issues that really drove me and that I was most passionate about were at the national level. Mm-hmm. International affairs for 10 years, I was the spokesperson for the party on foreign affairs, justice, human rights issues. Those were the issues that really drove me. Hopefully in a number of those areas, I came out as the first openly gay MP in 88, the height of the AIDS pandemic. There were three of us in the world. We used to joke it was the most exclusive club, that and people weren't lining up to join either in those days.
Of openly gay MPs?
Yeah, there were three of us. There was a guy named Barney Frank. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's an American congressman who just retired himself, actually, just last year. And then a UK MP and Chris Smith and myself. Yeah.
That's a pretty elite club.
and I didn't exactly start a trend in Canada. The next one was a guy named Ray Al Menard in 94, 6 years later. And then Libby came out, Libby Davies, in 2000. So, but I wasn't out in law school. I mean, and I didn't know of anybody who was openly gay or lesbian in law school.
And so would you we've talked to people who are very rooted in the 60s, who were at the law school.
Yeah.
Would you describe yourself as a 60s or a 70s?
I was a kid in the 60s. Yeah. I was a 70s.
Yeah, okay.
I had certain 60s mentalities, but I never smoked dope, I have to say. My roommate, I lived in a residence that's, I think, long since been torn down named Fort Camp. It was some, have you heard of Fort Camp?
Yep.
Anybody ever mention Fort Camp? Yeah. Yeah, I lived in Fort Camp residence, and my roommate when I was a first-year law student was a guy named Kelly, who immediately told me that he was going to be one of the major dealers on campus of marijuana, and would I like to, you know, sample his wares. And I'd never smoked anything in my life, and had a puff on this, and started gagging and coughing, and that was the first and last time. Not that, I mean, I've supported legalization for years, but I wasn't really child of the 60s, I was more a 70s person.
You, I don't want to keep you past your
thing, we're fine. Yeah.
What about the, you must have flown on that plane between here and Ottawa many times.
Oh yeah.
What did they, how did it work there with the party? Were you, you get into
my training at law school, UBC Law School, was incredibly valuable in the work that I did as a parliamentarian. I mean, it enabled me, for example, in committees to be far more effective in helping to shape legislation. I mean, I was able to have an impact on a number of pieces of important legislation. It enabled me to question witnesses more effectively as well, ministers, to grill ministers. And I mean, the skills that I learned and the knowledge that I acquired in law school was absolutely key to being an effective member of parliament. And I sat on the Justice Committee of the House of Commons for about 15 years. That was the first committee I joined when I was first elected in 27. First bill I tabled was a bill to repeal abortion from the criminal code, which again you can imagine was not without controversy. I worked very closely with Henry Morgenthaler from the time I entered Parliament. I was there in the Supreme Court when he won his historic victory in 89, I guess it was, beginning of 89, when the law was struck down, which basically achieved what I was trying to achieve through legislation, but the Supreme Court struck it down. And the work I did on the whole issue of dying with dignity and physician-assisted suicide, working with Sue Rodriguez, the skills that I learned from my professors at UBC Law School were really key in helping to shape that agenda as well. So it was a very valuable experience. I feel very privileged to have been able to spend that time, you know, even though, as I say, I didn't spend a lot of time in classes and so on, but I learned a lot.
Right. And how do you miss the do you miss being in the Canadian public eye?
In the House? Well, I mean, the circumstances of my leaving were so devastating. I mean, that took a long time to kind of heal from that, and I also went through some struggles in terms of my health, my mental health. That was partly connected to what happened with me as well, of course. But you know, I had to do some healing for some time after that. Part of that was running again in what I now call my kamikaze mission in Vancouver Centre. I mean, I didn't run in 2004, of course, but the first election after that was the 2006 election. My former assistant, Bill Sixay, actually stepped in after I had to leave. I didn't have to leave. I had lots of people saying, "Say, you don't have to go," but I had to leave. Personally, I had to leave in 2004. So Bill stepped in. He'd worked with me for 18 years and was elected and served for 6 years and did a wonderful job. So I wasn't going to come back and say, "Well, Bill, you know, I'm back, you know, I'm out of my old constituency," right? But I ran against Hetty. But Hetty was, you know, firmly entrenched in Vancouver Centre. So I ran again in 2006, but that was it. I'm cured now. In fact, Jack asked me if I would consider running again in my old riding, because Bill decided not to run. Bill Sixay decided not to run in the last election. And I thought about it for a microsecond or so and said, look, I appreciate being asked. Jack was a very close friend. In fact, when he ran for leader in 2003, there were only two members of the federal NDP caucus that supported him. There was me and Libby Davies. Everybody else supported Bill Blakey. Yeah, yeah. And I ran for the leadership of the party in 95 and launched my Ontario campaign in Jack and Olivia's living room in their house in Toronto. So I mean, very close friends. His loss was just so tragic. But he asked me if I wanted to come back, encouraged me, and I just said no. I mean, I had 25 years. In fact, I had just celebrated before the Ring episode. About 3 weeks before that, I had celebrated at the Orpheum Theatre my 25 years in public life, and Jack was there, and Noam Chomsky flew out from Boston to speak. Yeah. It was the only time he's done a political event like that. I had worked with Noam on a number of issues, and 2,500 people, we could have sold out the Orpheum three times over. And that was 25 years of public life. It was a great opportunity. And again, you know, just to come back to those 3 years in law school, that helped to shape my perspective on a lot of the issues that I addressed subsequently as an MP.
And the Ring episode, are you okay talking about? Do you feel comfortable talking about it?
Not at any great length, but if you've got a specific question.
Well, I'm not sure that I do, but I just remember the sudden the incongruity of the event and a specific question. How
did it happen?
sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, to this day, it was so totally shocking and irrational. People do things that, you know, you look back on it and say, well, how could this happen? I don't know how it happened. I mean, there were lots of different theories, endless theories, of course, because it was huge, you know, national media scandal, and endless theories and all sorts of different media. I mean, my lawyer was Clayton Ruby, who one of the best lawyers in the country and dear friend, and Michael Bolton as well was a local lawyer, and Clay's theory was that I had to get out of politics, and you know, this was the only way I could do it, was a self-destructive act. Who knows?
Sabotage.
Maybe it was bad, and maybe I was just bad that day. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I just, you know, you can analyze these things endlessly, but it was a terrible thing to happen. I recognized it immediately. I did what I could to, you know, undo it, but you couldn't unring a bell at that point. And I had huge public support. I mean, people were amazing. My constituents, my colleagues, you know, people said, you know, don't leave, right? But I ultimately, what I realized too was that I was struggling with some mental illness, and I didn't know what it was. But subsequently, it was diagnosed as a form of bipolar illness called hypomania. So I don't have the deep troughs that, you know, some people have in terms of the depression and so on, but occasionally, you know, get kind of manic. You can manage that with medication, as I did for some time. For the last few years, I haven't.
Well, I think people do tend to get, I mean, all professional people, and probably politicians as well, do tend to get caught up in their persona.
Yeah.
And which takes over their personality. Mm. I mean, this is pop psychology probably, but I've often wondered, what if you do have things you, as a person, you need to be working on?
Yeah.
And your job prevents you.
Well, I mean, being in the public eye too, and I was one of the best known politicians in the country. Being in the public eye, there's such a stigma around mental illness. And a lot of that is internalized too, right? I mean, crossing that threshold into, you know, the psychiatrist's office was one of the hardest things I had to do. I had a terrible accident as well. I don't know if you remember, but I went over a cliff at Galliano Island.
I do remember.
About 10 years before that, and almost lost my life. I had to crawl through the bush, and my jaw was smashed, and my leg was smashed, and ribs were broken, and everything else. And I mean, there was a lot of stress. I was in a wheelchair for 3 months, and I just didn't deal with it. I mean, I was recommended get you know, some counseling to deal with this. I never did. And so whether that contributed to, you know, what happened, I don't know. But all I know is that I'm in a good place now. I'm in a place where I can make a difference, help save lives and prevent infections, and use those 25 years of public life at the international level, which is what I'm doing.
How did that the Swiss work come about?
Well, I was at an international AIDS conference in Mexico in 2008, and a good friend of mine, Stephen Lewis, was there as well. And Stephen said, "Look, why aren't you doing this work?" Because I mean, I'd done a lot of work over the years on HIV/AIDS issues, and I said, "You should be doing this internationally." And there's this organization called the Global Fund. And I'd never heard of it before. He told me about it. I mean, I heard of it, but I didn't really pay much attention. And so he introduced me to the director, a French doctor named Michel Kazachkin. They asked me, well, you know, what about parliamentarians? Because I said, you know, what's the Global Fund doing to build support among elected representatives around the world, right? And they were doing nothing. And so they ended up asking me to tell them why they should be doing something with elected parliamentarians. And I did, and they hired me to do it, and 4 years later, I'm still doing it. So
that's wonderful.
It's a great opportunity. I mean, I meet with parliamentarians in donor countries. I speak to Foreign Affairs Committee. I was just in Korea, 2 days ago, speaking to Korean parliamentarians. Last month, I was in the Netherlands. I'm in the UK next week, meeting with UK parliamentarians. I'm in the New Zealand 2 weeks later to get them on board in support of the Global Fund. Then I go to Botswana to speak to something called the SADC Parliamentary Forum of African Members of Parliament about how they can make a difference in their countries. And,
what so is the is the name?
It's called the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria. Based in Geneva. Yeah. They're the three big killers in sub-Saharan Africa, and we're the biggest in the world in funding, providing funding support for them, and I coordinate the parliamentary relations for the fund.
And did you pick up French earlier as a
As a member of parliament, that was one of the first things I did, was to, you know, to learn French, because if I want to communicate with 7 million Canadians whose first language is in French, you know, I got to learn the language. And I had a particular aptitude for languages, so I'm fluently bilingual. I speak Danish as well, which is pretty useless, but and also Spanish. My partner's Cuban originally, and we go back every year to meet the family, and so I speak enough Spanish to get by. I'm not fluent, but I get by, which helps in, of course, in my current work.
So in a way, you're just as UBC was a stage for your national political career. Could you say that the Ottawa was a stage for the international?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I was able to build on that experience. And, I mean, politicians are strange beasts, and to have been there myself for 25 years enables me to talk to them, you know, in a way that a lot of other people can't talk to them, right? They know I've had that experience, that I understand the culture and some of the challenges that you face as an elected representative, so I can speak in language that they understand and respect and communicate with them effectively. I've got about 5 more minutes.
Okay. Here, so. Well, one thing I could mention is I've talked to, I think I've mentioned 3 people that we were talking to today, because we just lined up the interview yesterday. Graham also mentioned 1 or 2 people, and everybody said, your partner, partner's grandfather.
Quite impressed. Said, "Oh, that should be a treat." And she said you knew her grandfather, Harold Brown.
Oh, yeah, of course Harold's a wonderful... He's not alive anymore, but... No, Harold's an amazing guy. Yeah, Unitarian, and just a wonderful guy. In fact, I went and visited... He was in Felburn Hospital in North Burnaby for some time. Great guy. No, tell her that, you know, he's one of my favorite people, absolutely. He really is a wonderful man, yeah. And a great supporter of mine as well, yeah, for all the years I was involved in public life. Progressive... gifted, wonderful musician. He played at a number of events for me as well. So, yeah, that's great. Yeah. Well, but with me, honestly, with me, it was a love-hate thing. I mean, people tend, if they liked me, they kind of liked me a lot. But there were lots of them for whom I was the devil incarnate, right? You know, so not a lot of in-between. So if you tell some people you're meeting Sven Robinson, it'd be, oh, my God, him, no. But then other people would say, oh, he's a pretty good guy, you know. So.
Well, we didn't get any of that. And the guy we have, a house guest right now, and he said, say hi to Sven. He doesn't know you.
Oh,
so, nice. I mean, to me, it's interesting. In my sphere is... I work as an editor. I hang around the university,
sure.
And I might know a couple hundred people, maximum.
Right.
But it's so interesting to meet politicians like you and Mike Harcourt,
right.
whose sphere is must at one
That's
point have run
networks,
in the million. You know, people who knew you from at least from TV. So
sure.
I'm
it was
impressed.
A wonderful. It was a gift. I mean, really. It was just an amazing opportunity to have that privilege of representing, you know, these folks, and to have that support from them over all the years that I was really out there on the front lines. I mean, you know, I was the only MP who went to prison. I went to prison for civil disobedience, right, for Clackwood Sound.
On the Clackwood.
1994, I did a 2-week stint. Wally Opal said it was one of the hardest sentencing cases he'd ever faced, right? Mm-hmm. Wally was the one that sentenced me, and I stood in front of him and said, this is civil disobedience, and I respect the traditions, and I accept the consequences, right? And so I went off to Ford Mountain Institution for 2 weeks. And I was a repeat offender because I stood on the line at Haida Gwaii as well. You know, in 1985, in November of 85, I stood with the Haida people to block the logging at Lyell Island, right? So, I mean, how many people have had that wonderful opportunity that I've had? And law school was a part of making that possible. So, in fact, I've got to get going because there's somebody downstairs who's
okay.
I've never met who wanted to meet me, who said that I'd helped to change his life. He wanted to get me to sign a book for him.
Okay, well, thank you very much. But we have to.
Oh, I have to sign a release?
You have to give that to us. Actually.
Oh.